My topic is I'm going to talk about is about the broken symmetries and the quantum Hall effect, fractional quantum Hall effect, really in graphene. And this is going to be mostly about some work I've been doing together with a student at UT Austin, Inti Sadaman. Inti is looking for a good postdoc, by the way. So, my talk is going to consist of a long introduction and then some discussion of the fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene. The long introduction is motivated in part by our discussion yesterday on broken symmetries in quantum Hall systems. Eduardo mentioned one very interesting one. But in fact, and a number of people discussed analogous, you know, broken symmetry states in lattice systems, in Chern insulators. But in fact, broken symmetries in quantum Hall systems are very common. They occur in almost every system we look at. And they mostly have to do with the role of additional degrees of freedom. As you know, a Landau fractional quantum Hall effect is mostly to do with electron-electron interactions in a reduced Hilbert space of lowest Landau level or single Landau level eigenstates of a kinetic energy operator, in which the only degree of freedom is basically the center orbit center for cyclotron orbits. In addition to that orbit center degree of freedom, there are usually other degrees of freedom. And very often, the Hamiltonian is at least nearly independent of those other degrees of freedom. And the system breaks the associated symmetry. So I'm going to mention three examples. This gives me actually a convenient way of introducing some ideas that are important to discuss the fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene. First thing I'll talk about is spin. So as you know, one type of spin order, ferromagnetism, is occurs in many metals, and it can be understood with mean field theory ideas, in which increasing the spin polarization, of the system. Reduces exchange energy, and that competes with cost of band energy. And if the bands are narrow enough, as they are, for example, in the late 3D transition metals and their alloys, then you get the ground state is actually spontaneously spin polarized along some arbitrary direction in a first approximation. And turns out that these sorts of mean field theory ideas for spontaneous spin polarization are work equally well in quantum Hall systems and are, generally speaking, even on stronger theoretical grounds. The actual studies or history of studying spontaneous spin polarization of electrons in the quantum Hall regime actually predates the quantum Hall effect. The system is approximately spin rotationally invariant because spin orbit interactions can be taken to be weak, and because the G factor of electrons in many commonly studied systems is very small. This is kind of a summary of sort of experimental study of when electrons in nearly spin degenerate Landau levels spontaneously spin polarize. They're most likely to spin polarize when a spin degenerate Landau level is half filled. And studies of that state are very simple because in the restricted Hilbert space of the lowest Landau level, there's only one spin polarized state, and it's a single Slater determinant, so that the fully polarized state, you know exactly. It's just an issue of whether it's the ground state or not. And so this is a sort of Stoner criterion for spontaneous spin polarization in lowest Landau level. This is basically sort of the strength of exchange interactions and density of states, both measured experimentally by, this is a group in Duncan Maud and collaborators in Grenoble. And the important thing is that the thing that gives the bandwidth in the quantum Hall regime is disorder. Landau levels, of course, are perfectly degenerate in the absence of disorder. In effect, the Landau levels become broad if there's a lot of disorder, and then these spontaneous, these broken symmetry states don't occur when there's a lot of disorder. So this is nearly the last time I will mention disorder, but you should have in the back of your mind that none of this happens unless disorder is extremely weak. So quantum Hall, spontaneously spin-polarized quantum Hall systems, or quantum Hall ferromagnets, if you like, have one very interesting wrinkle that I will that most of you are aware of, and that I will mention because it comes back into my talk later on, and that is that, like any Heisenberg-like ferromagnet, or at least in a thin film, these systems have skirmion-type textures as excited states, where the spin is reversed in the middle of this texture, and the XY component has a vortex going around the texture. And as pointed out a long time ago by Shivaji Sandhi and collaborators, the special thing that happens is that there's a 2-pi phase winding. This is always true, but there's a 2-pi phase winding for a spin that encloses a vortex. And in a magnetic field, that phase winding acts just like an Aronoff-Bohm flux. And every skirmion allows you to fit one more state in a Landau level. So so these quantum Hall ferromagnets then are a little bit like superconductors, in the sense that in superconductors you can put lots of vortices inside a superconductor just by tuning a convenient experimental knob, which is the magnetic field. And these quantum Hall systems, you can put in these objects, which because of the change in the Landau level degeneracy, carry a charge. You can put them in simply by changing the electron density or changing the magnetic field strength. And in fact, if you go slightly away from half-filling, the ground state of the electron system is believed to consist of a fully polarized state with a whole bunch of skirmions inside it. And indeed, you can see that experimentally, as shown by Sean Barrett at Yale many, many years ago. What you see is that when you add charges to a full Landau level, or let's say even remove charges, that the overall total spin polarization measured by night shift in NMR drops very rapidly. That's because the charged objects actually carry many spins in general. Okay. The slope is a measure of the number of the size of the skirmion, if you like, the number of reverse spins in the elementary charged excitation. And experimentally in quantum Hall systems, it's typically around 4 or 5. We'll see that in graphene, there are skirmion-like things, but the number of reverse spins is smaller. Okay.
Four or five?
Yeah, smaller than 4 or 5. So. You laugh because 4 or 5 is not very many, or?
Yeah.
So there's.
I thought it was more like 20
in yeah, I think maybe you can get many. Of course, there are many attempts to measure the number of reverse spins and charged excitations by measuring activation energies and seeing how they depend on a tilted magnetic field. And that's a really, many things can go wrong with that way of digging it out. So. I don't know if it's ever been more than 4 or 5 in NMR type measurement. Okay, so this is actually to say that at fractional filling factors, spin polarized states, broken symmetry states occur at fractional filling factors as well. And this will come, is relevant to the fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene. Here's a recent summary of that for a two-component electron system, a system with a orbit center degree of freedom plus a spin a half degree of freedom, which, and I'm going to take the view in this talk that we basically know everything about that. And this is some summary of what we know based on a recent paper from Janendra Jain's group, in which he compares the energy of various states with different degrees of spin polarization as a function of filling factor. And you can see that at some filling factors, like a third fill Landau level, the ground state is fully spin polarized. At filling factor 2/5, the ground state is actually a spin singlet state. These states are labeled here by the just by the total Z component of spin, if you like, by the number of electrons of spin up and number of electrons of spin down. And because of the spin rotational symmetry, where because the Hamiltonian is spin independent, we can basically study all states we're interested in by taking states which have a definite number of spins in each component. And I'll do the same thing later when I talk about graphene. So some filling factors are spin polarized, break spin rotational symmetry, some the ground state does not, and we know everything about it when there are only two components. I'm going to talk later about the case of filling factor 2/3. These energies were constructed, as you might imagine, using a composite fermion picture, which doesn't work so well at filling factor 2/3. But we know from exact diagonalization that the spin polarized state at filling factor 2/3 is higher in energy by roughly the same amount that by which these states are separated, which is 1/100th of the normal energy unit used for Coulomb interactions, E squared over a magnetic length. But in fact, all of the states we're really interested in differ in energy by maybe 0.05 of E squared over L. So this is really quite a large energy difference. Okay, so let me now mention another example of broken symmetry in quantum Hall regime. This is the case of a bilayer 2D electron system. This is my favorite example, and Anton did some work on this in his PhD thesis. This is easy to do, of course, in semiconductors, where you confine electrons to quantum wells. You can make two quantum wells close together. And I can say easy since I don't grow the samples, but people know how to do it. And so there's a top layer and a bottom layer, and we want to keep with, if we want to keep with the spin language, we can view this as pseudo spin up and down. And as first pointed out by Herb Fertig, so this subject started theoretically, and it's one of many subjects in which a lot of the important early theory was done by Xiaogan Wen. And but basically, the ground state in mean field theory, unlike the spin case, where the Hamiltonian really is spin independent, in this case, the interaction between electrons depends a little bit whether the electrons are in the same layer or opposite layers. And that means that the interaction between electrons doesn't really conserve this pseudospin degree of freedom. So this mean field state I've written there is actually not an exact state, but a good approximation still. And becomes exact in a well-defined limit. And what it is a state in which if I have this layer degree of freedom, and let's say I arrange so that I have a spin-polarized system, then and I have enough electrons to fill up half of the Landau level that's doubly degenerate because of the layer degree of freedom, then the ground state actually is one in which I form spontaneously phase coherent combination of electrons in the top layer and the bottom layer. And so it wants to polarize. This is fully pseudospin polarized, but the pseudospin is, if you like, somewhere in the XY plane rather than the Z direction. And it wants to polarize, doesn't want to polarize in this pseudospin Z direction because that actually costs electrostatic energy of moving charge from one layer to another. And that's that tends to when to be the biggest energy. And so to avoid that, it instead forms a state with spontaneous coherence between the two layers. Okay? So this state is actually an exciton condensate. It's a people often talk about condensation of excitons that are photo excited. So that's some sort of non-equilibrium steady state in which people have actually seen all kinds of interesting bosonic coherence effects. But unlike that, this exciton condensate is a equilibrium state of the system. It's the ground state of the system. And you can see that this phase coherence between the layers means there's a non-zero amplitude for particle hole pairs where particle is in one layer and electron is in the other layer. The separate conservation of charge number in the separate layers, that quantum number or that symmetry is broken. So experimentally, the tunneling can be made to be negligible. Of course, it's never zero, but it really can be made so that you can't measure any consequence of it. Why do you say gap? There is a gapless. Yeah, so people can't actually, I mean, that would be a good measurement to do if you could actually measure the Goldstone mode. You know, one of the things I maybe should have said, emphasized at the beginning is in 2D electron systems, every 2D electron system lives in, like us, lives in a 3D world. And so you, if you want to study the 2D system that's not at the surface, very often the easiest measurement you can do is transport. And so you can't, that's the measurement you could do. You can't actually measure the Goldstone mode by sending your sample to Oak Ridge or something. Okay, but we know very well what it is, and it's, let's say, 5 or 6 orders of magnitude smaller than other characteristic energy scales. Yeah, so one of the interesting consequences of this state is that because there is spontaneous phase coherence between the two layers and there is an electron hole pair amplitude, the quasi-particles see, in fact, a large tunneling amplitude between the layers because of their interaction with the condensate. And I'll mention that interaction in a moment, but one of the things it does lead to is very interesting features in interlayer tunneling, which you can ask me about later. Yeah, absolutely. So this is a very old subject. It goes back a long, long time, and there were all kinds of conceptual confusions about is there anything super about these electron hole pair exciton condensates. There's a famous paper by Walter Cohn that says no. I actually gave a talk on this topic at the National Magnet Lab a number of years ago, and one of the co-author of that paper with Walter Cohn, David Sherrington, got up and started yelling at me. But anyway, so what did it give you to like? Is it super?
Yes.
Yes, I told him it was super. And but there were no experiments at the time, and he was skeptical. So I'll tell you, you know, it's the critical thing that about these systems is you have spontaneous coherence between electron systems that you can make separate electrical contact to because they're separated in space by a little bit. And if you couldn't do that, you wouldn't measure anything super. But yes, and that is of course true.
And also, they believe that if it is true, that it is impossible technologically to distinguish this from charge density.
So Boris has summarized the Sherrington cone paper. And that community of people would be extremely skeptical about this very beautiful phenomena that's seen experimentally. That the strength of the, the strength of the actual physical tunneling, which couples to the phase of this condensate, can be controlled experimentally, can be made very strong. And, just like a ferromagnet, still a ferromagnet if you have a little bit of magnetic anisotropy.
Well, I don't have anything against it. I'm just asking, ultimately, if you take into account tunneling, though it is very small, on very large distance.
Remind me at the end of this next slide or to come back to that, yeah. Okay, so there is a super effect, and now it has been measured very directly. This is the idea that I suggested a number of years ago and has now been realized by Jim Eisenstein. And here's a cartoon of my bilayer, and I guess I took the animations out of this, but the idea is there's basically no physical tunneling between the two layers, but an electron comes in, turns into a quasi-particle of the system, and sees, due to its interaction with the condensate, sees a huge tunneling amplitude and immediately tunnels to the other layer. Can't go through the 2D system because there's actually a gap. And so it's reflected with essentially unit probability from the top layer to the bottom layer. But just like a Andreev reflected electron at an SN junction launches a Cooper pair, in this case, this reflection process launches an exciton. And if you wire the system up in this way, then the electron, the quasi-particle went from top to bottom, launches an electron through this circuit. It will annihilate this whole part of the exciton coming along, and the electron part of that exciton can just go through the system, okay? So here's the corresponding experiment. Things are complicated in quantum Hall systems because you want to have a gap to see this effect, and edge states kind of can ruin that for you. So you have to use this Corbino geometry, where a one-dimensional transport of my cartoon is from the outside to the inside of that Corbino ring. And what's going on here is I have two 2D electron layers. It's actually an in-plane magnetic field that you use to tune the amount of tunneling. It's quite small to begin with, but with an in-plane magnetic field, you can tune it essentially to zero. So there's no tunneling between these 2D systems. Nevertheless, if you put a bias voltage across this closed circuit here, you find a current flows, even though there's a gap when you normally wouldn't expect a current in the quantum Hall regime. And most directly reflecting this exciton superflow across the system is the fact that there's no bias on this current loop in the other layer. Nevertheless, a current flows through here that is, under the right circumstances, exactly the same in magnitude as the current flowing through the upper circuit. So that is exciton superfluidity, and there is actually a deviation from this property doesn't hold Boris at very small currents. And so that fact that it doesn't hold at very small currents is a reflection of the fact that there's interlayer tunneling. So you can make some deviation from this property extend up to a certain current simply by controlling the strength of the interlayer tunneling. Okay.
One question.
Yep.
So that splitting is a function of VDC. What is that?
That is nothing's measured directly, of course, but it is. You can easily understand it when you take into account the fact that quasi-particles can also flow in response to this bias voltage.
Okay. So the blue and red is the measured, and the black is some calculation.
I actually forget what the black dashed line is. I don't think it's a calculation. Those might be two different temperatures or something. Yeah. Okay. Now, okay, so I'm taking too long, but I want to mention one other very nice example of a broken symmetry in quantum Hall system. This is now getting closer to graphene. This is, in fact, bilayer graphene that Philip was talking about yesterday. And it allows me to introduce another degree of freedom that's relevant, which is the valley degree of freedom. As you know, there are two Dirac points in graphene where there's a band crossing described by a massless Dirac model between pi bonding and antibonding orbitals. And this is the massless Dirac model. And in a magnetic field, of course, there's a Landau level, which is because these pi and pi dagger turn into creation and annihilation or raising and lowering operators for Landau levels. There's a Landau level, the one I'll be mostly interested in, which is on one sublattice only, and opposite valleys are in opposite sublattices. But without a magnetic field, what happens then if you're right at the Dirac point is that if you had an isolated layer, you'd just have two degenerate levels in each layer. And it turns out that the way these things stack, there is a hopping between one of sublattice in one layer and the other sublattice in the other layer. And that basically takes the Dirac point electrons on these sublattices and pushes them away from the Fermi level so they're not relevant. And the hopping process then at finite momentum to get from between the two sublattices that are still available in this bilayer system is basically to hop into this high energy state and then hop out again. So it's second order. And it turns that out that Hamiltonian in a magnetic field ends up having Landau level squared, or having these raising and lowering operators appeared squared because of that second order process. And so that's very interesting. That means that the Landau level at the Dirac energy in bilayer graphene, in addition to having spin and valley degrees of freedom, in the graphene case, these low energy sublattices are actually in different layers. So I call the valley degree of freedom layer here. And in addition to that, because this lowering operator acts twice, there are two states that are degenerate that have the same wave function as what would be the lowest kinetic energy and the next to lowest kinetic energy in a bilayer system. So this is what I call here a cyclotron orbit pseudospin or Landau level pseudospin. I just want to make a remark mainly about that. So first of all, this is actually from the paper that Philip was talking about yesterday, this data. So this is bilayer graphene on boron nitride. And the main point I want to make is that, this system has now, because of these 3 degrees of freedom, eight internal degrees of freedom, if you like, or 8 component spinners that describe the internal degrees of freedom, can hold 8 levels. And what you see experimentally is that you get a quantum Hall effect at every integer filling factor. And these are basically fill Landau level states where you fill some set of orbitals. And in fact, if you took the interaction to be independent of all of these internal degrees of freedom, wouldn't matter at any filling factor which ones you occupy. As Philip was mentioning yesterday, there's this very interesting competition that I'll also come to in single layer graphene between the magnetic field, which will tend to spin polarize the system, and valley-dependent interaction terms that I will talk about more a little bit later. But I want to mention, because it's not studied at all yet, and I think it's potentially quite interesting, and there's probably lots of things to think about theoretically also that I haven't thought about, and that's what happens when at odd filling factors. When we occupy only one of these eight Landau levels. So in Philip's data that I just showed you, he sees a good strong quantum Hall effect in bilayer graphene when only one of the eight Landau levels near the Dirac point is occupied. And if that state very likely is spin polarized by the Zeeman field and valley polarized because there are strong exchange interactions between states with the same valley, and that leaves it with trying to make a gap state by choosing to occupy a Landau level with some wave function, which is a linear combination in this of the orbital Landau levels with n equals 0 and n equal 1. And it turns out that it generally wants to, as indicated in that cartoon, not to occupy n equals 0 or n equal 1, although it can be probably tuned. But most of the time, it probably wants to occupy a coherent linear combination of those. And since these wave functions are n equals 0 is even, n equal 1 is odd, if you actually spontaneously put the electrons into coherent linear combination of those two, you actually have an electron dipole moment. So this system is, if it forms this kind of state, and that's not at all confirmed experimentally, it's a ferroelectric, okay? It has a finite dipole density. It's XY ferroelectric because these dipoles can point anywhere in the XY plane. And unlike typical ferroelectrics, it's ferroelectric based on the electronic degrees of freedom, not the lattice degrees of freedom, not moving ions around, but changing to make dipoles in an ionic crystal, but actually changing electronic wave functions. So this, I think, is an interesting state, should have interesting properties. For example, the direction, just like shape anisotropy in magnetic systems, the direction of the dipole should be controlled by the shape of the boundary of the sample. So I hope that will turn out to be an interesting subject in the future. And so now I've introduced most of the things I need to talk about graphene, and I think I have about 15 or 20 minutes left, which is good. Okay, so I'm going to say some things about the fractional quantum Hall effect and graphene. This is really from the PhD thesis work, a part of the PhD thesis work of Inti Sodaman, and Inti is actually an extremely thorough guy. And as he was working away on this, there were a couple of very nice papers appeared by Abedin and collaborators. Much of what I say, actually I'm going to say in the remaining of my talk, has already been said in these papers, but I'm standing here, so I will say it. Okay. So so now I'm going to talk about quantum Hall effects due to electron-electron interactions in single-layer graphene. Single-layer graphene doesn't have this extra orbital degree of freedom, so it's fourfold degenerate. It has spin and valley degrees of freedom. And the first thing to say is the strongest quantum Hall effects occur at the due to electron-electron interactions occur at integer filling factors. And these are presumably related to these mean field-like broken symmetry, or weak coupling-like, if you like, or whatever, broken symmetry states. And this is one neat way of measuring it. This is actually from Philip's lab, and it's actually measuring the chemical potential. One thing I'd intend to make is that, you know, we measure quantum Hall effect by transport usually. And it turns out that transport in these states with non-zero Hall conductivity is just measures that you have a gap. Whenever you have a gap, you get a huge whopping signal in transport. And that will happen whenever you have a jump in the chemical potential. So most of the literature on quantum Hall effect is about incompressible states, the states that occur at and near filling factors where there are jumps in the chemical potential. There are other experiments that indicate there's all kinds of interesting thing going on that's less of, available to experiment at other filling factors where you have compressible states. And I guess you might count composite fermion type physics. Yeah, near a half-filled Landau level among those. But anyway, what this experiment measures is a big whopping jump in the chemical potential when you go across an integer filling factor, which tells you you have an incompressible state, and also that the chemical potential just goes down as you fill a Landau level, and this tells you that at the biggest energy scale, the physics that's going on is kind of mean field-like, because this is just what would happen in a mean field theory. But in this experiment, you're starting to see features associated with fractional quantum Hall effects. And as the samples get bigger, those are becoming more and more clear.
So the jump is a gap?
Jump is the charge gap, yeah. It's the difference in energy between adding an electron and removing an electron. Okay, so these are the experiments that actually got us started on this. And this actual data is from Amir Jacoby's group, was published in Science in 2012, but there are earlier papers that see many of the same things. But this experiment makes it very clear that there's no quantum Hall effect when you have seen experimentally, and I'm not sure if Philip can say whether this is still true, when this, you know, four-fold degenerate Landau level has a filling factor of 1/3 or a filling factor for holes of 1/3. They simply don't see a quantum Hall effect. Is that still true, Philip?
One strange thing with that, but if there is a set, the gravity on the Voronoi
vector produces
the pristine graphene sample is.
Right, and so this is a suspended graphene sample. This is a thermodynamic measurement, color scale thermodynamic measurement of d mu dn, of compressibility. Yeah. So the light colors, I guess, mean that chemical potential is. Yeah. So chemical potential is changing rapidly with density. That's what you're picking out in this picture, where that happens. And it happens most strongly, as you can see, also in this picture at the integer filling factors, but there are also weaker features at fractional filling factors. And so why is there no quantum Hall effect for filling factor a third? And when I say filling factor a third, I'm measuring from just starting to fill these four degenerate Landau levels. And is perhaps, I'm going to say, not too much of a surprise. What maybe is more of a surprise is that you do see a strong quantum Hall effect at some of the other thirds. And the region goes back to skirmions, which I already introduced. It's debatable, I agree with Eduardo, about whether you should use the skirmion for these very small charged, word skirmion for these very charged small charged excitation, but so you can substitute, if you like, spin flip quasi particles. And but nevertheless, we know that even though a one-third fill Landau level, which is has its spin, has a favored spin direction because of Zeeman interaction, even though that has a large gap, if I have a two-component quantum Hall system and filling factor one-third, and I have no Zeeman splitting at all, then the gap is very, very much smaller. In this plot, this is a measurement of the a dimensionless measurement of the strength of the Zeeman interaction. These are units for appropriate to gallium arsenide, and the right-hand side of this curve in gallium arsenide would correspond to about 10 tesla. And these are the energies of various particle-hole pairs with the particles and the hole removed very far from each other. And Q here stands for the number of reverse spins. The ground state at a third is fully spin polarized. And so this a horizontal line here where I all these particle hole states are also spin polarized will have an excitation energy. This is excitation gap in normal E squared over L units. And it's independent of the Zeeman coupling strength. But if you consider, if you neglect Zeeman energy, then it's understood that there are excitations, particle and hole excitations that involve spin flip that have much lower energy. So this number for the actual charge gap at a third in the absence of any Zeeman coupling probably now can be estimated more accurately than this. I'm not sure if it's known more accurately yet. But it's roughly, let's say, somewhere between 5 and 10 times smaller than the spin polarized case. And so we can understand it being very hard, let's say, to see one-third compared to two-fifths. Two-fifths is a singlet state. Its charged excitation doesn't depend very much on Zeeman energy. But the one-third gap depends is reduced very strongly if you have no Zeeman splitting. And so if these are these states are spin polarized, by the actual physical Zeeman field, there's no analog of the Zeeman field for the valley degree of freedom. So for the valley degree of freedom, it's like having no Zeeman energy. Okay, so that makes sense that two-fifths is actually stronger than one-third. Okay. Now, if we think about what kinds of states we can have when we have four components to work with rather than two, I told you at the beginning I was going to take the point of view that we know everything about two-component fractional quantum Hall effect, and this is an attempt to think about the question, can you get other states that might have lower energy by taking advantage of having more than two components? And the answer is sometimes yes. And here's a very simple rule that this is actually Inti's simple rule. There may be other rules, or there may be other states besides this, but this is a rule. If you take a state that doesn't use all the components of the system and add a full Landau level for one component, then you get a state where the filling factor is increased by one, changing, for example, filling factor two-thirds state to filling factor five-thirds state. Okay, so and five-third was one of the strong fractional quantum Hall effects in those experiments by Amir Jacoby. There is the ground state. It is known at filling factor two-thirds, neglecting Zeeman energies, is a spin singlet or is a isospin singlet using whatever two components, whatever SU2 projection of this SU4 Hilbert space you like, and it's a singlet, a spin singlet. And so if you apply this rule, so spin singlet uses two components, and if you apply this rule, you get a three-component wave function. Okay? And so a very simple wave function. And because this, the reason for considering only the case of adding one full Landau level, is that, as I mentioned before, once a Landau level's filled, it isn't really correlated with anything. And there are still exchange interactions in the normal way of partitioning things. And so you can write down, if you know any state, for example, the state at 2/3, you can calculate the energies of the states that you obtain by adding a full, a new component that it, you fill up, and it just follows this rule. There are other states that are important. This is just using particle hole conjugation within some two-component subspace of the SU4. Okay, so this, we believe this state is actually, this three-component state is the ground state of the SU4 invariant fractional quantum Hall effect at filling factors measured from neutrality at filling factors plus minus a third, not the Laughlin state. Okay, and I'm running out of time, 5 minutes maybe? Okay. So the last part of my talk, I'm going to...
Sorry,
yes, I think this will work for bilayer graphene. Yeah, we haven't developed our thinking about bilayer graphene too much yet, but yeah. Okay. So, right. So the remaining part of my talk, I'm going to recognize something that we know from experiments that actually was the main topic of, or one of the main topics of Philip's talk yesterday, is that in graphene, the interactions are valley dependent. The electron-electron interactions are valley dependent. Not so valley dependent. It's kind of a weak correction to the Coulomb interaction, but maybe a bigger correction than we're used to in normal semiconductors, because graphene systems can be gated because they're atomically two-dimensional materials. The typical electron density people work with, aerial density, is much, much larger than normal, and the normal, effective mass type ideas, continuum models, don't work quite so accurately as usual. Okay. So this is neutral graphene that Philip was talking about yesterday. Neutral single, he was talking about neutral bilayers. This part of the physics is quite similar in the two cases, but this is neutral single layer graphene. And, if you had no Zeeman coupling or no single particle terms and you had SU4 and variant interactions, the ground state at neutrality would be occupy any two Landau levels. And then you could do any rotation you like in the SU4 space of those two Landau levels, and you get a degenerate state. Turns out that the valley dependence of the interactions, at least neglecting for the moment the Zeeman term, we now pretty much know that the valley dependence of the interaction selects among all those states this one, in which in one valley you occupy spin up states, and the other valley you occupy spin down states. So you can call this a spin density wave state if you like, although the because different valleys are in different sublattices, as I mentioned before, but the modulation of the spin is like 10 to the minus 5 electrons per carbon atom, so it's not a very conventional spin density wave. Yes, hold it now. No. Okay, so I put the wrong one here. Yes, so this is, I said the right words, but this is the wrong slide. I deleted the wrong one. So this is actually, this is the state, as I'll say in a moment, this is the competing state that you select by applying an external magnetic field. This is a spin polarized state. And this is the state that Dmitry Abinin, Patrick Lee, and others talked about a long, long time ago, This is basically a state for filling factor one for upspins and filling factor minus one for downspins. You can view it as a, you know, spontaneously spin polarized state, or you can view it as a spin Hall state because it has edge channels that go opposite directions for opposite spins. And in fact, it is the state that evolves adiabatically from a normal spin Hall state when you add a magnetic field. Okay. So this is a phase diagram that is related from a paper by Karatonov, and it sheds a lot of light, a theory paper, I should say, and sheds a lot of light on what experiments tell you about valley dependence of interactions in these systems. So the interactions are valley dependent, but and there are two effects, basically. There's a parameter here that's called UZ, which is basically says what I said before, interaction electrons in different layers is a little weaker than interactions of electrons in the same layers. And there's also another term which conserves total number of electrons in each valley, but is sort of a valley exchange process where one electron scattered from K to K prime and another one from K prime to K. And as I mentioned before, UZ is positive in these bilayer systems just because of electrostatic energy. So we're really interested in this part of the phase diagram. And the experiments Philip was explaining yesterday, bilayers and analogous ones in single layers, are pretty convincing that as a function of magnetic field, you see Zeeman appears in the denominator at this parameterization of things. So when you increase magnetic field, you move this way in this phase diagram, and you go from an antiferromagnetic state, which is the state that was described on the slide that should have been there, to a ferromagnetic state, which is the one that was there, okay? So I have to go a little quickly. So, these edge transport experiments and their evolution allows you to infer a lot about the strength in this is the single layer graphene case, about the strength of the of some of the valley dependent interactions. U is using here for this valley transfer interaction, and it it's basically the one that controls the competition between the spin polarized state and the antiferromagnetic state. And when you add a Zeeman field, it turns out the way you go from an antiferromagnetic state to a spin polarized state is by gradually twisting, canting the magnetization toward the field direction. And from this, you can, anyway, these curves, you can pick out the strength of this interaction, which seems to be roughly 5 to 10 times stronger than the Coulomb interaction. So this is this turns out in these systems, this breaking of SU4 invariance is more important than the Zeeman energy. Okay, skip that. Let me just make one aside, that is about the what is the physics of this effective interaction? If you think about this interaction as coming from some Coulomb process of electrons scattering from one layer to the other, it should be positive because Coulomb interactions are repulsive. But it's actually measured as negative if this canted antiferromagnetic state actually does occur. For positive, the system would always be spin polarized. What's the physics behind it? And this is at least, I'm not absolutely sure this picture is right, but this is from a lattice Hartree-Fock calculation. And basically it says that it turns out that when you occupy in this spin density wave state, you have the same sense of layer polarization, it turns out, for in both valleys for a given spin. And when you include exchange interactions across the entire Brouin zone, that is favorable. And I think this is actually, I don't have time to explain it in any detail, but this is actually the physics behind, microscopic physics behind that anisotropy. Okay, so the valley-dependent interactions are very important. And the main point I want to make here is at least here's an approach for describing its effect on the many electron state. It's we have these multi-component wave functions. And so all we do is we say we're going to attach a spinner to every wave function, just like when you have a ferromagnet, there's some weak physics that produces magnetic anisotropy and favors one spin orientation over another. And we're not worrying about the overall spin polarization when we include that weak effect. We're just saying it controls what spinners to attach to which component of the wave function. And so in general, we have these wave functions. We have some fully occupied Landau levels, some partially occupied Landau levels. And the low energy physics has to do with the partially occupied Landau levels where the electrons are strongly correlated. At filling factors bigger than one, you can't avoid having fully filled Landau levels. And what these equations express is the fact that the interaction between the electrons in the partially filled Landau level and the filled Landau levels, there's some kind of exchange interaction which acts like an effective magnetic field. And controls the size of the energy gap, acts very much like an effective magnetic field, as I was describing in the skirmion case, and gives you large filling factors, large gaps. Okay, so I think I should stop, and I will. Okay, so you can work out, and as I said, Inti's a thorough guy, and he likes to do these things much more beyond reason. So, this general phase diagram, you can laboriously minimize the energy with respect to the spinners you attach to each component, find a rich phase diagram. The actual measured excitation gap at filling factors measured from neutrality plus minus one-third that comes out of this approach is in pretty good agreement with experiment. In most regions of field, some of the charge excitations involve some spin flips, but at larger fields they don't. And so this picture is able to explain, apparently, perhaps misleadingly, somewhat quantitatively, the size of the gap at filling factor plus minus a third. And now I'm done. And I hope that I've convinced you that there's some interesting physics associated with broken symmetries and integer and fractional quantum Hall effects, and that there's much left to discover. Thanks very much.
Orbital degeneracy. All the 10 forms, if their dipole forms, the direction of the dipole can be important, right? Yes. So any comments there? What kind of the directions that of this dipole?
Yeah, so this is something I think is interesting, but I don't know exactly how. So one thing I've thought through a little bit is, this is an electric dipole. It's like having a magnet, right, which is a ordered set of magnetic dipoles instead of electric dipoles, except electric interactions are stronger than magnetic interactions. So there should be pretty strong effects. And just like, in a magnet, the magnetization from dipole-dipole interactions, you may recall that the magnetization likes to point along long directions of the sample. So it should be true if you make a Hall bar, the system will be, there will be an internal anisotropy, even on a microscopic length scale, which is controlled by the actual shape of the sample, some kind of shape anisotropy, which determines the direction of the dipole. That's what I think at present.
Do you need to include some of the other parameters to describe the direction of dipoles, kind of collective directions of the dipole?
Not as far as I understand. If you make a coherent combination of the n equals 0 and n equal 1 orbital, you have a dipole. So that is, you can call that order parameter a dipole, if you like.
Inversion symmetry would be broken in that
Or a mirror. Yes, symmetry. Yeah. So this, I mean, but according to this, there's entire rotational symmetry that is broken. Yeah. So it's not.
Simply because it's like a ferroelectric.
But unlike, you know, standard ferroelectrics, there are discrete directions determined by the lattice symmetry. Here it should be continuous because it's more or less mostly a continuum described by continuum physics.
Going back to this coherence effect from exciton condensation, I studied some experiments in optically pumped excitons involving bilayers.
Yes.
So you have an electron layer and hole layer.
Butov or. The Leonid Butov at UCSD has done.
So can they do this experiment that you are suggesting?
No. Yeah. You know, because the condensation in these optically pumped systems is in a rotating wave picture. It's actually the phase angle is rotating at, you know, some number of many terahertz, let's say. Yeah. But I actually am interested in, I think there's a very interesting possibility that, the most strongest example of this non-equilibrium exciton condensation, let me call it, is when you make an optical cavity and you make the excitons resonant with the cavity modes, okay, a vertical cavity. So it's a polariton, right? So-called polariton condensates. And they are also rotating wave picture. You know, it's really some phase coherence between electrons and holes, which is oscillating at some very high frequency, right? But there, you could imagine doing transport, vertical transport, and you can make the bias voltage also, you can tune that near the cavity photon energy. And then I think you might get some interesting transport effects. So that's one of the topics that I'm very interested in thinking about.
Any last question?
So this experiment with
right.
Can you mix the critical point message to the distance?
Critical point, so it seems like in this system there's a, in most cases anyway, first order phase transition between a coherent bilayer state and a incoherent bilayer state, and you can tune through that transition. It actually seems like this phase transition, so that maybe that's not so interesting, but if you actually get into the regime where even the states of the incoherent state are required by the Zeeman energy to be fully spin polarized, then it seems experimentally like maybe this transition is continuous between the coherent and incoherent state. And and then just so you could tune through it continuously. That's perhaps not been explored very extensively. So what people see is that these properties just kind of get weaker and stronger. I obviously showed you experimental data from the regime where these effects are the weakest, not the strongest. Okay.
Okay.